From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm John Wells. Our first guest this morning, Emma Loudon, originally from Park City, who's a Yale PhD student in astrophysics studying 4,000 planets and 500 solar systems with the goal of putting our own planet in context. And we look forward to our conversation with Emma Loudon.
Our second guest this morning is Daniel Bergner, who has written a new book called The Mind and the Moon. Bergner follows three individuals, including his brother, who experiences overwhelming depression, anxiety, and symptoms of psychosis. He explores the history of drug development, modes of treatment, and the marketing of psychopharmaceuticals.
These two guests when we return, plus today's cool story. Don't touch that dial. You're listening to Cool Science Radio. Stay with us.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with John Wells. Our first guest this morning is Emma Loudon. She's originally from Park City. She's a Yale PhD student in astrophysics. Now, we've all heard about exoplanets, you know, the planets that we have detected that orbit other star systems, but what do they look like and how similar or different are they from our solar system with eight planets? Our next guest studies these questions, and we're so happy she could join us this morning. Emma Loudon, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Well, we're excited to talk to you, and let's start here. I mean, I remember your name growing up as a young girl in Park City and throughout your years of high school, and it's just so interesting to examine the trajectory of a kid from Park City. So let's start with that. How did you get interested in astrophysics?
Yeah, so Park City is really an amazing place for so many reasons. But one of them is that when you look up at the night sky at night, you can see the Milky Way and you can see the stars. And that's not the case for so many places. So some of my earliest memories are going out to our front lawn when I was little and looking up the telescope with my dad at the moon, at different planets, at nebulas, and just being amazed by that sight. And then as I got older, my friends and I would go star watch at the Olympic Park and just sit up there and talk. And it was our way to decompress from the stress of school. And it was also our time where we could just lay back and look up at the stars and put everything into context. I didn't originally think that astrophysics could be a career, but I took a physics class in eighth grade at Treasure Mountain, and I loved it. I just completely fell in love with the puzzle piece nature of it, and that put me on the trajectory to studying astrophysics today.
Well, that's great, and I think most of us are envious of that, like kind of figuring out what we want to do starting in eighth grade. That's a wonderful gift. I'm kind of curious, too, like as there's more, less night sky visible as Park City grows and our surrounding area grows. I'm wondering, where are those wild places in Utah that you and your dad or you and your friends would go off to?
Yeah, so that's definitely, I've noticed when I go home now, I can't see the Milky Way from our front lawn anymore. So the light pollution is certainly growing. There are a couple different dark sky parks in southern Utah. I have yet to make some treks down to those, but they're on my bucket list, right outside of some of the national parks and some of the public lands there. It's some of the best sky watching anywhere because it's dry and that makes it easier to see the stars because you get less glittering in the atmosphere. And even anywhere where you can just get a little bit away from the city and be able to just look up and see how much is up there.
If you are just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're speaking with Emma Loudon. She's originally from Park City. She's a Yale PhD student in astrophysics, and she is with us this morning. I wanted to ask you about all the debris and all the satellites that are out there. Earthbound observation is now or in the future will be getting more difficult. I know Elon Musk has recently spray painted some of his satellites a flat black so it doesn't interfere as much. But there are thousands and thousands of satellites that are going up in the next 10 years or so. I know that you used Keck data. Keck is an observatory in Hawaii. Are there problems with these satellites, or will there be in the future?
Yes. So as an astrophysicist, there are reasons aplenty to be concerned about the amount of space debris and the amount of satellites that are launching. Because of the nature of Earth-based observing, those satellites leave streaks in the data that we can see. Sometimes at night, if you look up, you can actually see the Starlink satellites go across the night sky, and they are these really bright dots of, and they cover up all the starlight behind them. And that starlight is what we do our science on. It's what CAC collects the photons from that we can then analyze. And right now, the major concern is for big wide field surveys that are looking at the whole sky, because you get these satellite tracks through them and it covers up the data. In the future, there's the numbers change depending on who you talk to, but in the number of tens of thousands of satellites that are going to be launched in the next 10 years. And then that's going to show up in other data too. So dealing with that issue from a place of collaboration is going to be incredibly important. You mentioned the Starlink satellites getting painted. That's been something that SpaceX has done more out of the goodness of their heart than out of regulation. There is zero regulation about how to handle this right now. But that's something that's growing at a both national and international level, and is a conversation that is still very much in progress.
Yeah. And I mentioned Keck, which is one heck of an observatory. How do you work with them? Do you go to Hawaii? Do you have access to their database? Do you sign up for observation time and point the observatory at places you want to go to? How does all that work?
Yes. So as astronomers, we have this great thing called pajama observing mode, which existed pre-COVID, but has become the norm during COVID and after, where I can be here in Connecticut and in my pajamas and pull out my laptop and log on and control the observatory from my bed. It makes it amazingly easy to collect data. You get time on Keck by submitting observing proposals. They do it on a half-year basis. And you can do that either through NASA, which has just public calls for observational programs, or through the different institutions that have bought time on the telescope. And I'm lucky enough that Yale is one of those, so I can apply for time through Yale's allotment of nights. Although it's also possible to apply through NASA's allotment of nights. And all the data eventually becomes public. There's a proprietary period on it where scientists can do all their science and try and publish as many papers. And then it is data that belongs to everyone, because NASA, or it's a telescope that is partially funded by NASA money.
Lynn, can we do Cool Science Radio from our pajamas?
Indeed, we can.
We have a PJ party.
Yeah. Emma, I'm wondering what that felt like the first time you were in your pajamas controlling the observatory.
It was weird, to be honest, because it felt like I knew what I was doing. I knew that I was using this amazing instrument that's so powerful, but like I was clicking these buttons on my computer and it was lagging because it's going across so many time zones and everybody's internet's been lagging with COVID. And it was just a surreal experience to realize that I was collecting data that can tell us about our planet's place in the universe, but I was doing it like from my bed with a cup of tea and a cat next to me.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I'm wondering, how much do young astrophysicists like you have, you know, what is your role in approaching this issue, you say collaboratively, but this issue of space debris? And was it something that you all were able to predict was going to be a problem? And did you have like a solution in place?
So it's been a concern for astronomers as these constellations have started to go up. There's different organizations that are both international and national bodies that are starting to think about this issue. I think the speed with which it has grown kind of caught everyone by surprise. The sizes of these constellations and their predicted scales are just at a magnitude that I don't think anybody expected the speed of, or at least didn't think about. So there is no plan in place right now, really. And that is a concern for both the astronomical community, but it's also a concern for everyone, because not just astronomers rely on these satellites. These satellites are used for GPS, internet communication, military operations, our phones. We all have a vested interest in this issue. So as more and more satellites are launched, not only will it pollute the night sky, but there's potential for debris, there's potential for collisions. And if one of those goes down, then you can take down all kinds of services, and that will impact the whole planet.
I'm curious about what some of these other solar systems look like. And I also wanted to ask your opinion on this. They talk about the Goldilocks zone. But the Goldilocks zone, I mean, if you take our planet 90 million miles from the sun, it's in a great place. But if the sun was larger, we'd be incinerated. And so what do some of these other solar systems look like? And where are the planets relative to our solar system here?
Yeah. So this is my favorite question in astronomy to research. It's what all my research is around, because I think it's fascinating to compare our solar system to the other planetary systems and figure out whether what we have here is normal, whether it's the most common, to do planetary demographics, basically, and say, what is the most common type of planet? What's the most common type of planetary system? And it turns out, from what we've found so far, that our type of system is really an anomaly. The most common type of planetary system has a set of very small, very short period planets that would all be interior to where Mercury is in our own solar system. So our inner solar system is super empty. And our star, the other interesting thing, I think, is that our star is really well aligned with the plane that the planets are orbiting on. We think of the picture from second grade astronomy courses where you have your eight planets aligned and then you have the sun in the middle, and the sun and the axis that it's turning on is at a 90 degree angle to the plane the planets are orbiting on. You can think of putting a toothpick in a stack of pancakes. Our toothpick, which is the sun's rotational axis, is perfectly straight up, and our planets orbit on the pancake. But in other planetary systems, you can imagine sticking the toothpick in at an angle, or even into the side of the pancake. And that's what the star is rotating around. And there is growing evidence in my research that suggests that there are a lot of systems out there that have stars that are tilted like that, that have the toothpicks at an angle. And that suggests something about the formation of planets that we just don't understand yet. So to me, that's a completely fascinating question, and one that I hope will be answered in the coming years.
And we're also fortunate that we have these big gas giants in the outside part of the solar system that have such mass that they are doing an okay job collating and pulling some of this debris, asteroids and stuff, into their little asteroid belt and keeping clear from Earth. They probably also contribute to making things a little more difficult for us sometimes. But what role do the gas giants play in our stability?
Well, they help, like you said, keep the asteroid belt where it is. They Jupiter drags a set of asteroids at one of the gravitational stable points behind it. It's interesting because we are still learning about how many planets are even in other planetary systems. So to be able to compare how our gas giants help with stability here versus how gas giants in other systems help with stability, we don't even know the numbers of all the planets in the system. So it's a very first order analysis right now.
Em, I'm wondering if you find any other planetary systems to be really enigmatic, or something that kind of sets you off on a new trajectory of understanding or research.
So, some exoplanet astronomers have their favorite planet or their favorite system. I am not one of those. I love looking at it from the big picture and looking at the demographics as a whole. That's what excites me the most, because I think that that's what we can learn the most from. It helps us not just parameterize one system, but to be able to say, in the whole, what do all of these systems out there look like? And what does that tell us about how they formed? What does that tell us about how the Earth formed, about how our own solar system formed? It really puts our own Earth into context. And that, to me, is what I find most amazing. So I don't really have a favorite system.
You love them all equally, just our children.
Exactly.
And I'm wondering what you have found, what is the most amazing discovery that your research has proven out that has illuminated what's going on or what will happen in our solar system in the future?
Yeah, so it's hard to make comparisons that say, we think this happened in one system, and so therefore this is what's going to happen in the solar system. The most interesting result that I found so far that is out is that is the tilt of the stars. That was not expected. We knew that there were some systems where the stars were tilted with respect to where the planets orbit, but it was thought that maybe it could be like a one-off gravitational interaction from another star swinging by or a giant planet swinging by or something like that. But to find a trend that suggests that in these small planet-hosting stars, there is a trend for them to be tilted, suggests that there's something that we don't understand fundamentally about how these systems form. Because a priori, we wouldn't expect all those stars to be tilted. And so that begs the question. So what I'm doing right now is collecting KEK data for about 500 stars this spring that will hopefully be able to further answer that question, because it expands the sample by about five times and also expands it into hotter stars, which showed more tilts. So we can begin to explore why they might be more tilted than cooler stars and what that can tell us about planet formation. And then it does in some ways tie back to the solar system because it tells us these are the most common planetary formation mechanisms that would explain these weird exoplanetary systems. What does that tell us about how our own system formed? Did it form the same way? Did it form a different way? What are the different paths to create a solar system?
Wow, this is fascinating. Hey, Emma Loudon is our guest. She's a Parkite who is now a Yale PhD student in astrophysics, studying 4,000 planets and 500 solar systems, trying to figure out how we can put our own solar system in context. Emma, I wanted to ask you about the stability of some of these star systems. Can we tell how stable they are? We know that our own sun's pretty stable. Every once in a while, there's a colossal mass ejection, a CME of plasma, and sometimes it gets close. But for the most part, our sun is stable. Are some of these other stable star systems less stable?
So there are a couple different ways to interpret what you mean by stable there, but one is talking about stellar activity. So that's what like the coronal mass ejections are, is that the sun goes through cycles of activity, and those cycles of activity impact a lot of different things. They can impact electronics on Earth. They impact observations. And stellar activity is of major interest to exoplanet researchers, because when you observe a system, one way to do it is by basically just looking at the spectral signatures of stars. And it's very hard to differentiate what is stellar activity, what is the pulsations, what is a spot on the star versus what is a planet. So that's a very active area of research right now, is being able to figure out how to disentangle those two so we can tell how active are these other stars and also do they have planets. Because right now there are times where you can't really tell between the two because the signals are so similar.
Yeah. Emma, what one question do you have about astrophysics that has not been answered yet that kind of keeps you up at night?
What's the most common type of planetary system? I keep coming back to that because I just think it's the most fascinating thing that we can possibly learn, because it helps us put our own system in context. It helps keep perspective for our own life here on Earth. And right now, the data suggests that our own solar system is an oddball. And that's really interesting to me. So trying to figure out how and why that is the case fascinates me.
Mm-hmm. Emma, I'm wondering if you make your way back to Park City very often. Obviously, you're quite busy.
I love coming back to Park City. I make it back for whatever holidays I can. My family is still there, a lot of friends there, and I love coming back to the place that inspired my love of the night sky to begin with. Park City is such a special place, and the international and collaborative spirit that was imbued in the city by the Olympics is something that has created a deep passion for inclusivity and thinking from a big perspective. That's one of my core values. So I always love returning to the city that helped make me who I am today.
Yeah, that's a really great comment, you know, just tying it back into the Olympics. And I thought you were going to say the internationality of the Sundance Film Festival, all these influences, kids in Park City were really lucky to grow up with. Probably a lot of your high school buddies we just interviewed because they were part of the filmmakers showcase, you know, filmmakers. And I'm wondering, you know, if there is a role for someone like you to come back and especially inspire young women to head into science and even astrophysics and you know, what you do in this regard.
So I am extremely passionate about doing work to inspire young women and anybody who is not represented in science into space and into STEM in general. I think that's incredibly important because of many reasons. I do a lot of work with mentoring. I work with the Brooke Owens Fellowship. I helped found a program called Ask a Brookie that pairs Brooke Owens Fellows, who are women and gender minorities in the aerospace, with classrooms and students who need mentoring and who help, who want help trying to get into the aerospace world. I am in the process of building a new program that's going to help do more mentorship for girls in STEM that I'm really excited about. I think that it's really important to do this work for many reasons, but one of them is that it helps new kinds of thinking. And we know that old ways of thinking aren't going to solve our current crises. And so to have everybody's voice at the table and have all these different perspectives, problem solving and thinking collaboratively about issues from exoplanets to space debris to climate change, all of that, we need everyone at the table. And I'm super passionate about helping make that happen.
Yeah, we love your enthusiasm too.
Thank you.
the Hubble Space Telescope, we've all been a fan of that for 30 years, and it's completely changed science education. It's gotten people looking up in the sky again, which is nice. And we're also really excited. We've been following the manufacturing and the different problems and challenges with JW Webb. And that, of course, is now been launched. It's been tricked out, you know, the instrumentation panel, everything works. Looking into the future, what can Webb do for your quest for understanding what these planetary systems look like? I know it's being used for a whole bunch of different things, but will Webb add value to what you're trying to do?
100%. So JWST is an amazing instrument for many reasons. One of the things that it's going to be able to do is basically look into the atmospheres of these exoplanets and tell us what are the components of them. And that is a huge part of helping figure out what these planets are made of. And that can help tell us about their formation histories. It's also going to be able to peer back in time to the very first stars that formed and help us get a better picture of how star formation and galaxy formation happens, which then plays into how planet formation happens to better understand the environments that they form in. So Webb is an amazing telescope, and it's going to open our eyes to a lot of new and exciting science in the coming years, and I couldn't be more excited about it.
Yeah, and Hubble just released a photo of a early star system. It might have been 100 million years after the Big Bang, which is, you know, pretty quick. And they use cosmic lensing. They use galactic lensing to be able to focus in on this sort of thing. I don't really understand that lensing stuff. Can you describe that so we can get a better feel for it?
Yeah, so what that does is it relies on gravitational effects. So it's literally bending of light that acts as a magnifier for us. So you can imagine, so gravity impacts how light travels. And so what they're doing is they're using the gravitational effects of galaxies to literally bend the light and magnify what's behind it and be able to see it. There's a lot of cool optics that goes into it, and it's a fascinating part of being able to look backwards with cosmology.
Okay, thank you.
It's really amazing that both the Hubble and the James Webb Space Telescope are both, you know, probably of equal relevance, although doing different things. And you know, how much has that changed your course of research, knowing especially that James Webb would come online in the last year?
So I have not been dramatically impacted by the launch of it, partially because the launch was delayed for so long. When I was in undergrad, we were doing projects that were like mock telescope proposals for Webb launching supposedly that fall, and that was now 5 years ago. So it's been in the works for quite some time. So to rely on one telescope for research is a dangerous proposition. But I think that being able to use the different telescopes in both the ground-based ones and then also space-based ones like Hubble or JWST together is exciting and integral to my research because it enables us to be able to look at these systems through different wavelengths and from there learn more about their properties.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. I'm wondering if there's an observatory in the world that you haven't been to that you'd love to. I always think of going to that observatory in Chile, but then again, it makes me wonder if you can look at these, at the observations from your bed in your pajamas, does it really matter? I bet it does matter.
Oh yeah, I would love to. So I haven't gone to Kaka'i, Hawaii yet. I would love to go there. I also would love to go to Chile and visit Alma and the Atacama Desert. The observatories there are amazing. It's so dry. There's such high elevation. So it's just the most beautiful skies. And to go there and see those telescopes in action would be amazing.
Emma, before we let you go, because we're pretty much out of time, I wanted to ask you about algorithms. We have this space hardware, which is out there, and there's a lot of software involved, but there's new algorithms being developed all the time. What is the role of algorithms in helping you with what you're trying to do?
So algorithms are a way to solve problems. They're a way to solve complicated mathematical problems. There's a variety of different uses for them. One of the cool things about astronomy is that in a lot of ways, it's a really big data science problem. We have a ton of data that just hasn't been looked at from different perspectives. So you could make a case for not building any more telescopes for a while and instead just applying data science techniques, which involve a lot of powerful algorithms to analyzing that data and seeing what we can find from there.
We want to thank you for joining us today, Emma, and we would like to ask you to be our personal astrophysicist as questions come up on Cool Science Radio. We'll give you a ring and see what you're up to and stay in touch with us. We've enjoyed this conversation.
Well, thank you so much. I really enjoyed it. Happy to answer any astro questions that come up and really grateful for this opportunity. It's always special to get to talk about what I love and what I do now to people who know the place where I grew up and learned to love it. So
yeah.
Thank you very much.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells. I'm here with Lynn Ware Peake. We're just speaking with Emma Loudon, originally from Park City, who's a Yale PhD student in astrophysics. Our next guest was pre-taped last week. Here now is that interview. Enjoy. Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells. I'm here with Lynn Ware Peake. Our next guest is Daniel Bergner, who has written The Mind and the Moon, My Brother's Story, The Science of Our Brains, and The Search for Our Psyches. Bergner follows three individuals, including his brother, who experience overwhelming depression, anxiety, and symptoms of psychosis. He explores the history of drug development, modes of treatment, and the marketing of psychopharmaceuticals. Daniel Bergner, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
It's great to have you on the program. Very much enjoyed your book. It's a very personal story. Tell us how you organized this book and why you wrote it.
So it really starts with my younger brother. Back when we were in our early 20s, he was diagnosed just quite severely bipolar, put on locked wards, told, as were my parents, that he needed to be on lifelong, quite heavy medication. And much to my parents' terror, that if he abandoned that medication, he could well take his own life. He's a pianist, and he couldn't play as he wanted to because of the side effects. Took himself off after several years against all psychiatric advice. Did have some bumps into his early 30s, but has now lived a flourishing life for decades. And so that really raised profound questions for us about who we are, about our psychiatric selves, about the permanence of our selves, about how we should see ourselves. And I keep using our pointedly because, you know, although he was given this somewhat extreme diagnosis, I really think his story and the others I tell kind of emblematic of lots of things that are true for all of us.
Daniel, I feel like I know you a little bit and also know your mother and father. I mean, it's part autobiographical. It's part science. It's part comment on future types of medications that might be there, and all of the neuroscientists that you met with. But I feel like I know your family a little bit with the autobiographical piece. It was a fascinating upbringing for you.
Well, thanks for that. I guess I would, just for brevity's sake, point to a couple things. Both my father and mother, our father and mother, were really oriented toward science, right? My father's a public health director in Seattle at the time this all happened. My mother, a researcher in sociology. And I think they so wanted, as we all do as parents, to leap in and fix the situation. And maybe that in the end, although I don't fault them a bit, that was who they were. That was the time we were living in when we really believed emphatically in the new psychiatric cures. That may have been a mistake. It may have distanced them from my brother. It may have left him feeling really isolated. And one of the things I hope we'll get to is maybe a more balanced approach that parents can take, even in the most terrifying of situations.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Daniel Bergner. His new book is The Mind and the Moon, in which he talks about his brother's story and about the science of our brains and the search for our psyches. Daniel, could you speak to these other two cases? Let's start with a person named Caroline, who you look at throughout the book, as well as David. Let's start with Caroline.
Okay, so I wanted in the book, the reason why I wound up with these three personal narratives, to sort of cover the spectrum. I mean, David suffers from fairly common conditions, depression, anxiety. My brother, somewhere in the middle, was diagnosed with bipolar. Caroline, very extreme situation, at least in the eyes of conventional psychiatry. So from a very young age, even daycare, she's hearing voices, the voices become really lacerating, telling her parents are going to die, her family's at risk, et cetera, et cetera. So really, in the eyes of psychiatry, she would have the worst of prognoses, and she's heavily medicated with antipsychotics and other drugs. The problem with that set of drugs is the side effects are so severe, real, real weight gain, not just 10 pounds, like 50 pounds in her case, and that's not uncommon. Tics, so really a sense that your body is out of control, and a kind of sedation, all that can make living just almost impossible. So she goes on like this, flash forward to her 20s, and finally takes herself off medication. And here's the improbable part of the story, partly through becoming a roller derby star in Asheville, North Carolina. She finds a new way to manage, a new way to be. And I just want to say, people hear this story and they just think I'm nuts because it can't possibly be true. It is true. It is true. And I'm just going to give you a quick example. So Caroline hears voices still, and sometimes she'll ask me to repeat a question because her voices have been that loud. At the same time, yesterday, we were emailing about her interpretation of Melville. Now, this is a lesson to all of us. This is not a debilitated human being. It is a human being dealing with a somewhat different set of circumstances. And that leads us to all kinds of questions about, you know, I'm going to get all too philosophical, but we need to. What is reality? To what degree is my reality your reality? I think Caroline, because she's lived with very different realities in different spaces simultaneously, kind of helps us to think about the subjective spaces, the personal spaces that we all live in.
That's a really good point, and I can see why you included her in the story. And then, you know, perhaps something that more people can identify with is the story of extreme depression, and that is the story of David. Please tell us about David.
Right. So David is the only person whose name I had to change because he's a really prominent civil rights lawyer, as a kind of heroic background. He's argued in front of the Supreme Court. But along the way, he began to feel like he was just incompetent, afraid, didn't care, all sort of symptoms of not just depression and anxiety, but you know how any of us, when we feel low, let's just say that, kind of go inward, and he really went inward. But here was the additional problem. His therapist had originally said, look, you don't really need medication. Your case is fairly moderate, and you're making progress. Let's just go with the therapy. He thought, no, I want to try medication. You know, as Prozac and other drugs were becoming more and more prominent. That led him down a path that didn't really work for him. And then when he tried to go off, he faced all kinds of symptoms, which we're hearing about more and more. We didn't for a long time, but the last few years we have withdrawal symptoms that can be pretty debilitating. Not for everyone. I don't want to preach against medication. That would be so arrogant and irresponsible. But these are real things. They're doing things to the brain. And for him and for a fair number of others, getting off of even those common drugs can be difficult.
Daniel, your father was an accomplished public health official who wasn't just, you know, looking good in the position. He found situations where people were not safe, where our kids were not safe. And he was able to put in systems like the windows in New York and, you know, the guards over the windows to save lives. So your father was used to being successful in tackling problems. And I could feel his pain as he went through this, where he felt, in a way, helpless. And it was very difficult for him. And it's in all of the people that Lynn and I speak to about this subject, we hear a similar story that if you have resources, insurance, or if you don't have resources, it is so hard to navigate the system and to find strategies to help your loved one who's going through these mental health crises. And some of these, you know, we're talking about potential suicides and things like that. So it's very, very serious. But there's so many people in this country who are having trouble navigating this. Is there any hope out there in the way we deal with this as a society?
I think yes. So sometimes I can sound awfully dark because the science, you know, as neuroscientists told me again and again, really hasn't advanced in half a century. But I think there really is reason for hope. So you're pointing into two layers of problems. One is just access and navigating and shortage of care, all true. The other, though, I would say let's look at the family and let's look at what I've been through as a family member, my parents, et cetera. And you're right. My father fixed some real problems. Kids falling out of windows to their death. Heart attacks that, you know, were beyond, heart attack victims beyond reclamation were helped because he put machines into EMT vehicles back in the 80s. Caroline has this motto, if I'm controlling, I'm not connecting. And she applies this to the situation of suicidality. So if I'm a parent, what do I want to do? I want to control this situation. I want my kid, number one, probably on a psych ward where they can't hurt themselves for at least those 2 weeks. Never mind what will happen thereafter. Very little evidence that the 2 weeks helps down the road. But I want them safe right now. I want to fix this. Another of her mottos, take off your cape. What she means is you probably can't fix it. You know, we know that about our kids in all kinds of other ways, but when it comes to the highest stakes way, we are going to try to fix it. What if, she asks, instead, if we can, we just listen, we connect, we create a bond that removes, to some degree, whatever degree we can, difference, shame, isolation, and we just listen to that child. It's so hard. I know this from my own children. I'm laughing because it's the hardest thing of all, but it may be the saving thing. And I'll give you a specific example. She has this really innovative program around suicide prevention, which is spreading now quite a lot of momentum around the country. So as the pact is, if you enter these rooms, you cannot call 911, no matter what anyone says. The faith is that simply by listening, you will reduce the odds, simply by making people feel heard. But once you introduce, I'm going to punch the panic button, you remove listening because you're assessing rather than listening. It sounds super simple. It's a very profound insight. And it's fascinating. I've been to these trainings. It's fascinating to watch people react to this in different ways. It can be really frightening, but I think it's also really profound.
Well, she had some great insights. Where, you know, she's pretty smart then.
She's off the charts smart. Yeah. And I think that's what we often don't see, particularly with the psychosis diagnosis. Conventional psychiatry will say, oh, this person can't have insight because they're existing in another reality. I've spoken to so many people now with psychosis. That's not really true. Sometimes in real crisis, they're temporarily beyond my reach. More often than not, they're aware of two worlds. And that means something really different. Caroline is able to fully converse with me in the world we share, even as she's seeing things from an entirely different point of view. It's an important thing to point out because it allows us a kind of trust in the insights of people like her.
I think it's so fascinating that you bring up this point, especially, you know, it does make a case for sort of parallel realities or parallel universes or things like that, and that we ought not to dismiss them so readily with, you know, in even a psychiatric evaluation. I feel like you, Daniel, have chosen these three stories because, as you say, and one of the things that you're trying to accomplish in your book is to explore the difference between our brains and our minds, our psyches and our brains. And, you know, what to you, how do you explain that? What is the difference between our brain and our mind, or our brain and our psyche?
Right. I think it's an important one. So I'll go to one of the neuroscientists who spent his life studying depression in a very, very particular and fascinating way. And he told me two things. One, when I, Dr. Nessler, started my career in the 80s, I thought psychiatry would be right behind cancer research. We'd cure all this range of ills. As it's turned out, we haven't gotten there with cancer. And cancer, he said, is so dumbass simple compared to the psyche. Second lesson is, we were long taught, oh, you're depressed, you'll take this medication, it'll balance you out just like diabetes balanced out by insulin. Well, no, because any other organ in the body, little bits of it, even the cells, in many cases, you can go Google the heart cell and it'll be pumping. It's doing what the organ does. Our brain cells, that's not true. Our brain cells are not thinking. It's these interactions of 100 billion brain cells that create thought. That, to me, hearing that lesson from him, even though he's totally committed to continuing to find better pharmaceuticals, hearing that kind of insight from him really woke me up, began to make me think, where can we go next? And I think here's a key thing for the conversation. So there were a set of neuroscientists who were willing to talk, as one of them apologetically said, about the woo-woo. And what she meant was, and again, she's a molecular neuroscientist, she meant was, there are spiritual things at play here, however we want to define that, traditionally religious all the way over to more mindfulness. There are spiritual things at play here that we need to recognize. We're not going to be able to fix our minds the way we fix a broken leg. And one of the ways to think about fixing our minds or helping our minds, well, two of the ways. One is to hold rather than repel our symptoms. And she would quote that old Paul Simon lyric, "Hello, darkness, my old friend." She wasn't saying, let's go all the way into darkness. She was just saying, let's not be scared of this. And she was saying, as many neuroscientists do, let's find a place for ourselves in something larger. It's that sense of meaning that can really mitigate the problems that, again, I think we all at different times face.
That makes a lot of sense. And yet this sort of bringing together this connection between someone who is a neuroscientist, you know, heavy into molecular biology, and the woo-woo, those things are increasingly, I think, and hopefully and hearteningly coming together. Like one is not completely dismissing the other. At least that's how it should be, I think, in modern psychiatry. Would you agree?
I completely agree. So I can't get the quotation right, but Einstein spoke along these lines. For starters, yes, this may have to be where we go. One quick example of this, one among many, is the research that's gotten so much attention in the media around psychedelics and depression or PTSD. So there's a lot of media hype. This is going to be the new eureka. Not quite, but if you look at the studies carefully, the ones that do succeed accompany the psychedelic with extensive therapy of a very particular kind. So I've read the manuals, you know, the 50-page instructions. It's about guiding the recipient toward a sense of self. And literally these phrases are used, oneness, self within the cosmos, et cetera. It's like we're using the drug to open things up rather than the kind of closing in or isolation that comes along with our psychiatric challenges.
I'm curious if Big Pharma is able to monetize psilocybin that occurs naturally in mushrooms. They like making money. So are they pushing back on this? And then another question, I heard some anecdotal information. It's not, I don't know this as a fact, but somebody told me that Big Pharma companies have really slowed down their research in products to help people with mental health problems because they are also sort of throwing their hands up saying, you know, the mind, this is pretty complex stuff. We don't know if we could monetize this in the short term, the way their monetization models work.
You're absolutely right. So there's been a cutback, some would say around 80% cutback in drug development around psychiatry for exactly the reason you say, that the mind has been recognized to be so complex and we haven't made progress in so many decades. It's an interesting affirmation of what I'm saying, that we may have to find new ways. To go on to psychedelics, can they be monetized? Yes. The scary thing is that one of the ways they're monetized is sort of these strip mall, you know, little storefront where you can get infused with a psychedelic without the kind of guidance that I just noted. So, okay, you're taking a drug. There might be some small percentage of people who benefit from that. Probably not lastingly. That's just not right. And our media bears some responsibility for this.
And where would one go to be able to find a psilocybin program? Not a study where you could have a placebo, but an actual therapy session.
Right. So I'm not equipped to recommend, but I can just mention two places. So Johns Hopkins has a pretty well-known research institute around this. Something called MAPS, M-A-P-S, is a good place to go. Listeners who want to at least explore this, and they should explore with care. I'd say almost certainly don't want to go the underground route, which David, the depressed character, does. But listeners who want to explore this, those would be two places to look for thoughtful approaches.
Well, unfortunately, we're just about out of time. We've really enjoyed this conversation. We'd love to have you back to continue this. Daniel Bergner has written The Mind and the Moon, My Brother's Story, The Science of Our Brains, and The Search for Our Psyches. Daniel, we wish you continued success with the book, and we look forward to the next time that we have a chance to talk with you.
Well, me too. I'd love to talk again, and I'd love to just invite readers, read the book, give me some feedback. Go to my website, danielbergner.com. My email's there. Please, that's an invitation. Share your thoughts.
Daniel, thank you very much.
Thanks, you.
Thanks, Daniel.
And thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio here on KPCW Park City. I think we have just a minute remaining for a little cool story, right, JW?
Yeah, and before I introduce this, I just want to ask our listeners, if you have any show ideas or things you're curious about, you'd like to learn about, just drop us a line at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org. org. I know one thing I'm interested in is how we get away from this password thing. And for decades, we've needed passwords to do things online. Well, new forms of authentication are now going to get us away from them, hopefully. So instead, we'll use a link that's sent via email or text, a push notification, maybe a biometric scan, which is cool because you don't have to remember your face. You just have to get your face in front of your computer or your phone. But Lynn, I don't know about you, but are you looking forward to passwords moving away?
Oh boy, I was over passwords like 10 years ago. I'm just one of those people who does not operate well with passwords. I don't have any efficient means to keep them mostly.
So
that's great. Another cool story that I saw in the MIT Technology Review has to do with how we store renewable energy. So something interesting, last April for California's main electric grid, about 95%, this was just for a moment, a few seconds on a sunny afternoon, renewables provided enough power to supply 95% of demand. So this is a big deal. We're getting there, but how do we store it? This remains the question. So now there are a few companies, one in Oregon, one in Massachusetts, that have raised a lot of money, and they are doing research on a new type of battery, batteries that use iron, one of the most abundant materials on the planet, to store. And they're finding that they can store energy up to 100 hours. So this is really promising. We know this is another thing, along with passwords, that we have needed to, you know, overcome and discover a new way to add an element to renewables that, you know, will help us use complete renewable energy in the future.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I can't wait for that either. That's going to be good. Cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin, they use a ton of electricity. Matter of fact, mining a single Bitcoin can, the electricity that is used could power a 3-bedroom home for 8 months. So it's really crazy. But anyway, some good news coming. Proof of stake is a way to offer ways to verify transactions without using so much energy. And Ethereum is planning to transition to the system, and it's going to cut energy use by 99.95%. We want to thank everyone for joining us on Cool Science Radio. We'll be back next week.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio.
If you want to share it, all our shows are under the Shows tab. We also podcast all of KPCW's Public Affair Hour shows. Wherever you find your podcasts, you can find them under KPCW and the individual show name. So look for KPCW Cool Science Radio.
If you enjoyed this episode, please rate us, give us a 5, and leave us a comment.
Take us along on your next adventure to the moon.
If you have any story ideas, please let us know at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org.
Thanks for listening. And hey, tune in next week.